So what is this spirit? What is this paradigm? What is this sunnah that great men of the last century, of the 19th century, were invoking and that gave rise to these extraordinarily chivalric, noble, magnanimous, civilized modes of conduct, even when you're faced with an enemy that is the very opposite? So we'll look now at the prophetic paradigm, which I'm referring to as ilm, knowledge, hilm, a word which I'll go on to translate in a moment, and rahma, which we can translate as loving compassion. When the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was asked, "What is the religion most beloved to God?" What was the answer? He didn't say Islam. He didn't even say the Deen of Fitra. He didn't even say the Deen of the Hanafa. He said simply the primordial, generously tolerant faith, Al-Hanafiyya As-Samha. Al-Hanafiyya in another version is Al-Hanifiyya. It refers to this religion of primordiality, the original religion of swerving, which is one of the root meanings of Hanaf, to swerve always to the truth, whatever things may be happening on the circumference. Always go for the truth. But how do you go for the truth of the one God, of the one reality, with this samha, which we need these words to translate, generous, gentle tolerance. That is the religion that the Prophet, in a hadith which is in Bukhari among other sources, is very strongly authenticated. He said, this is the religion that is most beloved to God. In other words, instead of referring to such and such a religion, he refers to a quality which, if it infuses the souls of the people in that religion, the upholders of that religion, renders that religion most lovable to God. So we're not talking about labels, institutions of religion. We're talking about qualitative distinction of those who are tolerant and generous, who have samha, at the same time as being rigorously hanif, rigorously monotheistic, worshipping one reality and remembering the power that goes hand in hand with the great embodiment of the religion of the Hanif, which is Sayyidina Ibrahim alayhi salam, destroying false idols. So there's a strong aspect here, which is beautifully balanced by the second qualification, samha, gentle and tolerant, that renders that strength a calibrated quality and not just an uncontrolled rage or fanaticism or an intolerance. This saying of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, now breaking my own rule, I said I would try and abide by it, but it's difficult not to invoke blessings upon our blessed Prophet each time you say the word the Prophet. But of course in English it does jar, so I'll try not to do it for the rest of the talk. He said in a saying that is a kind of counterpart to this one, "I was only raised amongst you as a prophet. Innama bu'ithtu. I was only raised up, sent forth as a prophet to you, in order to make perfect the noble character traits. لِأُتَمِّمَ مَكَارِمْ الْأَخْلَاقِ So that I may make perfect for you those noble character traits," which, of course, his modesty wouldn't have allowed him to say so, but those noble character traits that he embodied to perfection himself. So if we ask the Qur'an, what are these character traits, we're stunned by the extent to which it's rahma, it's love, it's gentleness that prevails in these prophetic descriptions of the prophetic soul. In one verse we're told, "There has indeed come unto you a prophet from amongst you. Whatever harms you is grievous to him. He is ever caring in your regard. Unto the believers, he is kind and lovingly merciful." This is in the Surah At-Tawbah, verse 128. And the words to describe him as kind and merciful, lovingly merciful, in fact, because rahmah really is loving mercy. It's not just mercy on its own. is Ra'uf and Rahim, which are both given as divine names. Ar-Ra'uf is the kind, referring to God. Ar-Rahim is, of course, the loving and merciful, referring to God. The importance of this gentle and tolerant predisposition, therefore, cannot be overemphasized in Islam. The Quran bears testimony to the key role played by this quality of the Prophet in attracting people to the religion of Islam. This is an extremely subtle point, extremely grievous to me, that no one really pays sufficient attention to this verse in accounting for the success of the spread of Islam. I don't see it in the books, and I don't see it in many lectures. But this verse is of absolute centrality in understanding the success of the Islamic mission from the beginning. What was it? What quality was it that attracted people? Was it the Quran? They didn't have a Quran. They didn't have a text. They had these verses that were written on various parchments, on palm leaves. But what was it that attracted the people to this religion? It was this human being through whom these extraordinary words of wisdom came. But it was this human being that they were attracted to, which is why they thought once he's dead, that's the end. There's no Islam. Let's all go back to paganism. Because we really follow this man, the majority, the thousands and thousands of Muslims who entered the religion. What is this verse then? It's verse 159 of the Surah Al Imran. It was a mercy from God that you are gently disposed to them. Linta lahum. فَبِمَا رَحْمَةٍ مِنَ اللَّهِ لِنْتَ لَهُمْ. Had you been fierce and hard-hearted, they would indeed have fled from you. It was a mercy from God that your nature is to be gentle and kind and warm and loving. Because if you had been the opposite, if you had been fierce and hard-hearted, what would have been the result? People would have fled from you. You would have been just like any Jahili tribal leader who's very good at promoting his tribe and his ego through this fierceness and all this bravado and machismo, we would say today. The Prophet, rather, is told to say to us, if you love God, follow me, God will love you. This is the quintessence of the call that's been made. If you have any inkling of what love means for God, and if you have any slight inclination towards God with this loving heart, then follow me and God will love you. And if we ask how do we follow this Uswa Hasana, it's really predominantly in terms of this beautiful example of love and kindness. And this is not to say that the Prophet's strength or courage or resolve is being marginalized or minimalized. It's merely to say that what prevailed in the soul of the Prophet was what prevailed in the heart of God, Rahmah. Why God describes himself as saying, I have written upon my own soul. God has written, كَتَبَ عَلَى نَفْسِهِ الرَّحْمَةِ. God has inscribed upon his very being, Rahmah. So the Prophet's predominance of mercy is only a reflection on the human plane of the divine predominance of mercy within the essence of God. He's described in the literature as Ahlam an-Nas. In the early seerah literature, he's described as the one among men who was most possessed of Hilm, which I said at the beginning of this section is one of the three words I would use to describe the prophetic paradigm. Hilm. And if we can understand this quality, we can get to the heart of Islamic virtue. And we cannot understand the roots of tolerance in Islam without understanding him, why he was called Ahla an-Nas, the most possessed of this quality of him. The Japanese scholar Toshihiko Izutsu, in his pioneering work on key Quranic terms, writes as follows, that the Qur'an, as well as the prophetic soul, is dominated by him. It's not just the prophet's soul, but also the whole of the Qur'an and the divine nature that's dominated by him. So if you understand Hilm, you understand the Prophet's soul, which was like the Qur'an, according to his wife, Aisha radiallahu anha. His soul was like the Qur'an. So if you understand the prophetic Hilm, you understand the Qur'anic Hilm, you understand God as Al-Halim, which has often been rather weakly translated as the mild. But in fact, as Izutsu reminds us, this mildness goes hand in hand with infinite power. And it makes that mildness or the gentleness all the more striking and all the more irresistible because it's based on power and not on weakness. One might translate it at a stretch, this word Halim, by saying gentle. But then we have to use gentle in the old English sense, as a when we talk about a gentleman, of whom there are very few, unfortunately, today. True gentlemen are very rare, but we still have the word al-ism without the musamma. But the gentleman in English, in traditional English, meant a nobleman. It was related to nobility of soul. And what was nobility of soul all about? Self-mastery, self-dominion. It was about aristocracy in the Platonic sense of the term, not the elitist social sense. The aristocrat was one who dominated himself with the best of what he had within him, his intellect, his virtue, to dominate the lower tendencies of the soul, which are caprice, whim, passion, ignorance, and all the other vices to which we're prone. So the true aristocrat was the true gentleman, one with true nobility, makarim al-akhlaq, and that true nobility and gentleness is all about the strength required to overcome one's own lower tendencies. Then we're understanding what Hilm is all about. And there's a poem which Izutsu gives us in this remarkable book of his, helping us to understand key Quranic terms. It helps us to understand the opposite of Hilm, which is Jahl. You would think that the opposite of Jahl is Ilm, the opposite of ignorance is knowledge, but in fact the opposite of jahl is hilm. Why? Because jahl is not just ignorance, it's the passionate intensity of self-promotion, aggressive self-aggrandizement, which arises from knowledge, from a lack of knowledge, arises from ignorance. So we should always remember when we see jahil or jahiliya, we're not just talking about ignorance, we're talking about ta'assub, about tribal fanaticism. And that fanaticism leads to aggressive self-promotion. Opposed to that is Hilm. And as I say, Izutsu gives us this poem that helps us to a pre-Islamic poem, in fact. Many are the large black cooking pots which our servants take good care of. But once their belly becomes jahil, in other words, when they boil up, when these pots boil up with their contents, that's how jahil was used, boiling up with his anger based on a kind of ignorance. But how do you apply ignorance to food? That's the kind of associations that these great poets in the pre-Islamic period wanted us to have, to associate this jahil as not just an ignorance on a conceptual plane, but this emotive, explosive force that is unleashed by ignorance. So here we have the poem. Once these pots, their bellies become jahil, when they become boiling up, they will never become halim. And I don't mean the Indian dish. They will never calm down. Halim, to become really gentle and calm. So you see how wonderfully this helps us to understand the nature of hilm, of being calm, of being possessed, of this self-dominion. And I'll just finish with this definition that Izutsu gives us. Hilm must be understood as a positive and active power of the soul that is strong enough to curb the soul's impetuosity, to calm it down to patience and forbearance. It is a sign of the power and superiority of the intellect. Therefore, when God forgives sins, it's based on the infinite power that God has to do what he will, but without any of the human qualities of the human susceptibilities to passion that affect us. So he has hilm based on infinite power. We will have hilm to the extent that we can somehow reflect on the human plane the divine hilm, so that we can have compassion, gentleness, but based on power, not based on weakness. Not a kind of anything goes idea of tolerance, and not a sort of craven capitulation to an ideology of charity. Rather, you have true charity, true gentleness, based on a dominion of the self that means you don't have any of those angry sentiments bubbling up from within that will then go out into others, make you full of your pride and your own aggression. And the only way to do that, of course, is through fighting what the Prophet called the Jihad al-Akbar, the greater holy war, against all of these lower tendencies. So, we won't go into the Jihad al-Akbar at this point. We'll just go on with this idea of Hilm being linked to Rahmah. Remember the famous verse of the Surah Al-Anbiya, Surah called the Prophets, verse 107. We did not send you forth, وَمَا أَرْسَلْنَاكَ إِلَّا رَحْمَةً لِلْعَالَمِينَ. We did not send you except as a loving mercy to the whole of creation. Put in the negative, we did not send you except as. In other words, we only sent you. Look at the exclusivity attached to this rahmah. We only sent you, O Prophet, to the whole of creation as a rahmah. It's a very, very powerful verse. And as we saw earlier, Imam Shamil stressed that what you have done, when he said to the Emir al-Muqadir, what you have done is to remind people of what the prophetic mission was all about. You have put into practice the noble example of this messenger of God. Bearing witness, he said, to the compassion for all of his humble creatures. The divine quality of Rahmah, therefore, radiates through the soul of the Prophet to the whole of creation. Those who follow him come to understand that it is only through the strength granted by compassion that you will be given the power to overcome your own weakness, your own whims, your own passion, your own, what the Quran calls hawa. The Quran tells us, do you see the one who takes his hawa as his God, as his Lord? In another place, it's the other way around. Do you see the one who takes his Lord to be his hawa? The hawa is precisely this whim, this caprice, this passion, this subjectivism that prevails over the intellect. To get over this, we need that strength that comes through compassion. As Imam Ali famously said, that in this Jihad al-Akbar, you have ar-Rahman that opposes the forces of ash-Shaytan in the soul. It's not al-Qahar that opposes ash-Shaytan, the all-conquering, the all-powerful. It's the ar-Rahman, it's the lovingly compassionate that is against Shaytan in the soul, just as the aql is against the hawa. Now this cosmic scope of the prophetic rahmah enters into the soul of every single follower of the Prophet in the very measure that we really try and follow the Prophet. Even if the universality of his compassion is his preserve as the Prophet of mercy, it can be realized to some degree by all of us insofar as it exerts a real spiritual influence upon those who are struggling to imitate him, to emulate him. In other words, the intention to radiate Rahmah to all beings must be the defining feature of the souls of all those who claim to be followers of the Prophet. The intention to be a vehicle by means of which Rahmah radiates to the whole of creation must be the defining feature of anyone who claims to be a Muslim and following this prophetic example, this Uswa Hasana. One might ask the following questions, however. Is this relationship that we're trying to establish between the prophetic Rahmah, the prophetic Hilm, and the practice of tolerance in Islam, is it not idealistic? Have Muslims throughout the centuries really been so spiritually sensitive to these subtle dimensions of the prophetic example? This person asking these questions may well ask that these periods, these great examples of tolerance that you've had in your history, are they not just expressions of realpolitik, political expediency, on the part of the holders of power, the princes, the sultans, and so on? My reply would be that the practice of tolerance on the level of the state cannot be divorced either from the precedents established by the Prophet himself on that same plane of politics, nor from the radiance of the prophetic virtues, one of which is precisely, in fact, benevolent, wise governance. Political analysis might be content to refer to the relationship between prophetic precedent and tolerant practice. But if we want to go into the deeper wellsprings, what was it that propelled holders of power, fuqaha, theologians, throughout the 1400 years of Islamic history, to manifest the spirit of tolerance? We have to go into the prophetic character, into this example on the level of the spirit, not just on the level of politics. To appreciate the impact of the prophetic example on the whole of Muslim society, we need to look and appreciate the fundamental role of veneration of the Prophet in Muslim piety. And I don't need to speak very much about that to today's audience, but for Westerners, it's often missed out in their evaluation of the Islamic endeavor. Such is the degree of emphasis on the transcendence of God above and beyond all forms, all thought, all conceivable quality, tanzih, that they don't realize the extent to which Muslims compensate for that transcendence by focusing on the immanence of the divine qualities within and through the soul of the Prophet. And that plays a fundamental role in Islamic piety and not just in spirituality. This example for the Muslims is made accessible. We're told in Surah Al-Ahzab 33, verse 6, the Prophet is closer to the believers than their own souls. Ola bil mu'mini min anfusihim. It's no coincidence in our time that the devotional practices which most emphasize love of the Prophet are the one like pilgrimage to shrines where the Mawlid is celebrated. It's no coincidence that these practices are the ones that are most targeted by the fanatics, by the fundamentalists, the iconoclasts of our times. Because negating the remembrance of the hilm and the rahmah, characterizing the prophetic personality, is essential for those who wish to portray Islam as an ideology. For those who wish to present and promote Islam as a political ideology, it's absolutely essential to negate those aspects of Muslim devotion which characterize the Prophet as full of hilm and rahmah. Those are enemies for the fundamentalists, the fanatics, the ideologues. I'd like to quote here what Shabir Akhtar wrote about the posthumous authority of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It's a very appropriate way of referring to it, the posthumous authority, the authority that outlasts the death of the Prophet. This is a message that, again, my teacher, Sheikh Obaid Siraj al-Din, emphasized on the very last occasion that he spoke in public, a few weeks before he died. He said, the Prophet has not died. His death is only apparent. His presence is here with us. It's always accessible to us. Shabir Akhtar says this: the influence of the Arabian Prophet on the lives of millions through the patterns of his biography, daily imitated, is without parallel in the whole of history, religious or secular. The imitation of Muhammad is an accepted obligation, a routine occurrence. It is the ideal not only for saints, but for all Muslims, from the beggars in the slums of India to the spectacularly wealthy sheikhs of Saudi Arabia, from the illiterate peasants of Pakistan to the erudite scholars of Al-Azhar, from the village women of the third world to the sophisticates of Western female society. Muhammad is dead, but he is dead only in the least significant sense. The fact is that the Prophet of Islam is resurrected daily in what must be, this is a very good sentence he wrote, The fact is that the Prophet of Islam is resurrected daily in what must be the greatest triumph over the limitations of physical extinction. Now I want to move to another dimension of the prophetic paradigm, which is the relationship between knowledge and tolerance. As most of you may know, one of the most often cited verses in relation to tolerance in Islam is verse 256 of Surah Al-Baqarah. There is no compulsion in religion, la ikraha fi din. The relationship between knowledge and tolerance is fundamental. The more we know about the religions of the other, the more we will respect and tolerate them. Now, why should there be no compulsion in matters of religion? It's because religion is divine in its origin. And those people who uphold religion, whatever the religion may be, are upholding something divine. And so Islam has this unique capacity in its sacred scripture to talk about the way in which all religions stem from the same ultimate, transcendent divine reality. I'll just cite one verse for you in this regard, verse 48 of Surah number 5, which is Surah Al-Ma'idah, which says, "For each of you communities, we, God, we have established a law and a path. And if we wished, we could have made you one community, one ummah. But we made you as you are, in order that God may try you by means of that which he has given you. So vie with each other in good works. Unto God you will all be returned, and he will advise you, he will tell you about the things regarding which you had differences." It's the key verse, I would say, that establishes the divine legitimacy of religious diversity, one might say. When this is established on the level of true knowledge, then it becomes impossible to be intolerant regarding other religions. And this is what animated, to some degree or another, all of the great warriors of Islam, the great conquerors of Islam in the early centuries of Islamic expansion. This knowledge that the people they were encountering were following a religion that is rooted in God, even if the present practices or beliefs may be to some degree distorted or corrupted or degenerate. But we don't know the extent to which this degeneration has taken place, so we err on the side of caution and say we have to grant tolerance to those other believers of other faiths. In the famous farewell sermon of the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in 632, 9th of Dhul-Hijjah, he cited the verse which tells us, "O mankind, we have created you male and female. We have made you into tribes and nations so that you might come to know one another, لتعارفوا. Truly, in the sight of God, the most honored amongst you is the most pious amongst you. In akramakum indallahi atqakum." Then he added, "Just as your God is one, so is Adam, your father, one. No Arab has any superiority over a non-Arab, nor any non-Arab over any Arab. Neither is a black man superior to a white man, nor is a white man superior to a black man." So this is a robust rejection of racism, of intolerance at all levels. It establishes this ta'aruf, or the reason for this diversity is not that you should claim one is better than the other, but you should come to know each other and thereby come to a deeper knowledge of your own selves. Since no religious community is deprived of guidance, the Quran tells us, "For every ummah there is a rasul." Therefore, when you come across any ummah that you don't recognize, that may come from a prophet that has not been mentioned in the Quran, the Quran tells us some of the prophets we've told you about, others we haven't. So you do not know when you come across, for example, the Native American Indian tradition. You have no idea whether that was rooted or not in a revealer And of course, if you investigate that tradition and you see what they say about the Great Spirit, about Wakantanka, what are they talking about if not something that's come straight from the oneness of God? So there has to be this innate predisposition to tolerate and respect the religions of the other if we take this knowledge aspect of the Quranic discourse seriously. Now I want to give you a few concrete examples of what this meant in practice in the Prophet's own time. And probably the most important example is that of his response to the Christians of Najran in the year 631, when the Christians of Najran in Yemen had come to negotiate the terms of a treaty with the Prophet, and they also engaged in debate about the nature of Jesus, I would say, Isa. There was disagreement about the nature of Jesus. But when it came for the time to pray, the Christians said, we will leave Medina and we'll go and set up a makeshift altar in the desert, which they used to do, and we'll perform our rites there. And the Prophet said, no, you can pray right here in the mosque, in the Masjid al-Nabawi, the most sacred spot of Medina. And the Christians were described as Melkites. They followed the rites of the Byzantine emperor, meaning they were Orthodox Christians. They were enacting all of the Trinitarian dogmas of the church councils in their rites. So what the Prophet was implicitly saying was that I will disagree with you theologically, but I will give you every right to perform your devotions which are based on that theology. You not only have every right to do it, but you can do it right here in my mosque. And if there was any element of shirk involved in talking about Jesus, the Son of God, the Prophet would not have allowed such a thing to have occurred in his own mosque. So this is a very powerful argument that there may be fundamental disagreements on the plane of language, concept, theology, which can go hand in hand with the most profound veneration, respect on the level of devotion, on the level of that devotion that goes to the metaphysical reality, the truth that goes beyond all forms. And that is expressed likewise in a wonderful document which I've seen myself in St. Catherine's Monastery in Egypt, in the Sinai Peninsula. And it was apparently written by Sayyidina Ali, alayhi salam, dictated by the Prophet. And it is as follows. Wherever the monks or hermits are to be found, on any mountain, hill, village, or any other habitable place, on the sea, in the desert, or any convent, any church or house of prayer, I shall be watching over them as their protector, with all my soul, together with all my ummah, because they, these monks and hermits, are a part of my own people, part of those protected by me. And very significantly, in this document of charter of protection to the monks of St. Catherine, the Prophet says, not only are they to be protected, not only are they part of our ummah, part of our dhimmah, they are also to have their prayer consolidated at church. That is a key phrase in the document which I've read. What I've read actually is a copy of the original, a copy that was made by Salim and his scribes when they conquered, the Ottoman Emperor Salim, when they conquered Egypt. So it's tamkin is the word. Yumakkin. You have to make firm and strong the Christians in their worship. That's how much we are obliged to respect the Christian mode of worship. Now I think we're probably running out of time, so I think just one more example of the prophetic tolerance. And this is an incident that is found in historians such as Waqidi, and it's related by Martin Lins, Sheikh Baksir al-Jadeen, in his biography, using sources like Waqidi and Azraqi, early historians, that when the Kaaba was taken, when Mecca was conquered, and the Prophet entered in triumph, he ordered all of the idols to be destroyed, but he protected with his own hands an icon of the Virgin and Child, and said, not this. Now, it's been disputed by many people. Is it conceivable that the Prophet would have destroyed all these other, quote, idols, but not this one? The argument says the Prophet could not have left such an icon, even if it pertained to a true religion. He wouldn't have left it in the Kaaba. A monk can agree with that. He would not have left it in the Kaaba. He would have taken it out and given it to a Christian tribe for them to take away and to guard. And that's the simple argument against those who say this act is inconceivable. What I would argue is that it's all too conceivable, given what we've already heard and the way the Prophet acted to the Christians of Najran when they came and prayed in his own mosque. They were, if you like, enacting a kind of iconic form of prayer in what they did. So there's no contradiction between him protecting an icon and giving it to a Christian tribe, recognizing that there's no common measure between these pieces of wood that represent man-made images, idols, and this icon that represents something sacred and real stemming from a true religion, an icon which is a window opening out to the transcendent. So the fact that the Prophet engaged with the Christians on this level enables us to see that such an act, as well as the charter, which also is disputed in some quarters, these are eminently credible. They're lent credence, credibility, by the fact that the Prophet acted in this way to Christians. So let me just conclude by saying that the impressive record of tolerance in Islamic history cannot be disputed by any historian. Nor can it be doubted that this record of tolerance is rooted in the presence of the prophetic soul. This presence is always accessible, and it can be deeply felt by those who are sincerely making an effort to emulate this noble example. Those, by contrast, for whom Islam is not about emulating the gentle qualities of the Prophet, are the ones most likely to fall into the jahili trait of fanaticism and intolerance that I was describing. So even if the voices of that intolerance are bellowing loudly around us, it behoves us to uphold, to the extent possible, the gentleness of the prophetic nature, based on the strength of self-dominion. It's not a gentleness that's weak and that reacts to the apparent strength of the fanatics. It's a gentleness that's based on the power that comes from emulating the prophetic presence. And it will be strengthened by that presence, in the very measure that our sincere orientation to it is rooted in our hearts. We'll be empowered by that presence, in the measure of the sincerity of our effort to emulate that prophetic example. So I just want to finish with the words of the Emir Abdul Qadir when he replied to Shamir, saying as follows, words which are as relevant, more relevant today than they were when the Emir uttered them in 1868. When we think of how few men of real religion there are, how small the number of defenders and champions of the truth, when one sees ignorant persons imagining that the principle of Islam is hardness, severity, excess and barbarity, it is time to repeat these words. Patience is beautiful and God is the source of all succor. Quoting verse 18 of Surah number 12, Sabr and Jameel, Wallahu Musta'an. Thank you very much for your attention.